Hey, good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Punkonomics with Dr. Benjamin Balick. My name is Jesse Velez, and Happy New Year.
That's right.
That's right.
Hello.
Oh, okay, so
machines.
New Year's, what are we going to talk about?
Right, I don't know. Well, we have with us Jose Galvez is going to help us out.
Hello, everybody.
We should also have Jay Gordon and Corey Carroll, our other our usuals. So I'm sure everybody will help us out.
Like New Year's celebration party.
New Year's celebration party.
Yeah.
All right, right. Yeah, a little like a reunion, you know,
alumni reunion. Yeah, exactly.
Reunion, all different times, different angles. It's all alumni, you know, which is kind of cool. Yeah. Right. So yeah, New Year's, you know, I'm a little bit ritualophobic myself. I don't go much for rituals.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Me too. Although I did, I go over to a friend's for New Year's and, it was just like, we were really like really quiet, just listening to music and stuff, you know, nothing special and stuff. But, I mean, that was special, but you know, the typical, let me spend $200 and $300, to be in a club or
forced fun for me. I mean, but yeah, I'm problematic. I'm not very, you know, probably my fault that I don't get it. I'm not judging, but I'm a little bit difficult in that way.
So does anybody know about that burning tower in Dubai? Oh.
Yes, actually, I have a pretty interesting story about it. I have a friend who just went to stay to that hotel for her honeymoon.
Oops.
Whoa.
Yeah, she got married recently and she sent a picture and she was like, hey guys, we're all okay, but this happened to the hotel where we were staying. It was like in flames. Apparently they don't have, I don't know.
Sprinklers?
That's probably one, but like a lot of construction standards. So it's like very fast development.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So like you have all these amazing structures. That's apparently some people I've been hearing. It's rumors, of course, so you don't want to... Right, but at the same time, apparently what I heard is it's not the only hotel where this has happened, right? Like
really?
There are other constructions there that have had similar
problems. But the last thing I heard about it was that what they found that's consistent is the material itself. I guess it's some sort of a plastic shielding on the outside, which is probably why most of those buildings are like really so shiny for being out there in the desert.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what it is, the coating.
It's impressive. I mean,
there's an inevitable, you know, always that issue, right?
Right.
That you build something, eventually, hopefully, very rarely, it'll burn down.
You gotta be careful. Right.
It's part of that illusion of I mean, sure, we have standards that should, or at least at some point had been established by professionals, so by engineers.
Yeah.
But then there's the pressure to cut costs, and how does that play through the political system, regulatory system? I mean, we have the same problems here. I mean, you know, let us not, every time I cross a bridge in America, right?
You kind of wonder.
I hold my breath, right? It's one of the problems that we don't reinvest in our infrastructure, but at the same time, it's true that you could get a glitzy, highly financed, yet not democratic, you know, not representative place like, most of the Gulf states, or all of them, in different ways. Then you, and in Asia a lot, we saw that too, like 20 years ago, right? When Asia blew up, right? You had accidents happening in Bangkok and
right.
And
I mean, to
like
the
that.
Date, you
today
have
too,
like
right.
Millions of accidents all over the place.
So the shiny new
factories falling down and stuff like that.
Right.
Well, in New York, when it was being built or kept being built, I mean, back in the 30s and 20s, I mean, they lost people like crazy. I mean, some of the old black and white film that I've seen where people are actually standing on a beam.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
that's impressive.
That's incredible.
Crazy professional.
It is.
But yeah, so I mean, it's always the issue, right, of safety. You can't get it's a classic economic issue, right? You can't get perfect safety. I mean, then you wouldn't do anything, all right? The way to that, that reminds me of that, my favorite insane thing. When I trawl the right-wing conspiracy websites for my excuses that I teach a class on propaganda, but I always say that I have this kind of warm corner in my heart for right-wing conspiracy nuts. It's whatever. I don't know. Sorry.
Warm corner in your heart.
reflect something about my problems, probably. But you remember when I saw this ad on Alex Jones's site for basically a box, right? A coffin-resembling box that you actually bury yourself in and close the door when the zombie apocalypse or whatever, you know, event you wanna call it, happens. So you don't even have to be killed by whoever it is that is out there, right? You bury yourself alive. Yeah. So that's safety for you, right? So yeah, if you bury yourself alive, that's as safe as it gets. Of course, most of us at least don't want that. I wonder how that coffin is selling. so you have to assume a certain amount of risk, and maybe today a little, certainly historically in the rich world, we expect remarkable degrees of safety. So we can make jokes about propeller parents for the millennial generation, whatever, right? And I was a parent like that, so I know the pressure. And right. I fall for it, too. I fall for it like any other parent, you know? Mm-hmm. My kids must be fully safe. No, you know? You can't do it. But historically, at least, it's very true that now we live in this... we had a bubble of safety if we were fortunate enough to be members of the, you know, middle class and above in the rich world, right? Throughout history, that wasn't the case. So people expected their kids to die, their parents to die, everybody to die almost in most history. That was,
yeah, the Energizer Bunny, you know, they just keep on going and going.
What do you think drove the bubble though? Like, it was definitely like political to some extent. Like, the world just gets like new political reasons to increase safety, right? But there's also a huge industry behind it. Right,
sure.
That can monitor and control what you do, that can detect metal, that can do all these things to put in airports and stuff like that.
And also in so many levels, and so many applications.
Like some safety aspects of the bubble. I wonder, like, what other factors, like, drive people to seek out to be more safe in what already is a relatively
safe
place, right?
You know, what you said a moment ago it connects in my head to a couple of things that I really like a lot. The notion of... Well, the political, right? But I'm not talking parties here. I mean,
No.
A very broadly political era we live in. The neoconservatisms, the new wars. So this past, or even further, you can take it all the way to the Maggie Thatcher, Ronald Reagan era and the philosophers that kind of launched that in the 70s. Michael Curtis? Am I getting confused with names? I always get confused with names, so, you know, help me out. Mm-hmm. He's a BBC documentarist, and he did some wonderful work on that. Precisely the notion, the idea that governments promised us in certainly the post-war era, prosperity, right? Opportunity. Work hard, do well, you know, set up your kids, all of that promise, the modernist, in some sense, promise. Of the few bright technological prosperous future, yeah, and then it kind of failed in the 70s, right? Mm-hmm. So now they can't even with a straight face really promise us that anymore. So they promise to protect us from nightmares, right? Mm-hmm. Promise to protect us. So that's the focus. Now you can go zoom out in the history of thought even further and go to one of my favorite characters, because it's so misunderstood. No, not Adam Smith, but Vilfredo Pareto. And he had a theory that's more influential in political science and economics of elites. So essentially, here's the redux, right? Very, very unfair redux. Sometimes societies get all vibrant, right, and innovative, and allow crazy new ideas even when they're not popular or against our religion, you know. And these are periods of innovation and success often, right? In periods of change, definitely. So these are the societies that lead and take over, and like Britain and Holland took over France, you know, in Europe by changing, by adapting rapidly and effectively. So you have that. But once you're doing well for a while, there's this ongoing pressure to be more conservative. And I'm not talking in like current American political language conservative, but in a more fundamental English language, right? You want to keep what you got, to conserve what you got. Yeah. So you got these attitudes of, oh, it was perfectly well for my parents. There's no reason why it shouldn't be well for you. The worst mistake in humans can utter, in a sense, because when things change, you have to adapt. If you don't adapt, you are in fact signing your death warrant. in the long term. So indeed, these societies, as they become powerful, they're elites instead of being elites of innovators. We have elites of preservers, you know, just not to use, because conservative is such a loaded term today, right? But want to conserve what we have. And that invariably leads to a rigid, not flexible society that is no longer able to adapt to changes, and it's in decline. So he saw that as a kind of a fundamental driver of the rise and fall of societies. You know, and he spent his, having finished all the mathematization of economics that he felt was warranted, in the turn of the previous century, he spent the rest of his life looking very carefully at this sort of things, like really reading history very carefully, trying to discern patterns, really what's in common between the British Empire and the Roman Empire, you know, maybe and the Borgia family and different papal families, and, you know, just comparing powerful groups and how their rise and fall, and trying to find common things. America, in some sense, though at his day, of course, it was just. But he looks at America precisely as an era of, there's a lot of weird and some nasty stuff going on, no doubt. Again, talking about the end of the 19th century, but he sees America as being very flexible. Because so he's kind of explaining the rise of America when it's happening, right?
Right, makes sense.
By observing, that's why the Americans are doing so much better than the British, in some sense, he's saying.
I wonder what he would think if he had a view of it today.
I figure that that he would say that, well, yeah, the inevitable happens to them all. Maybe a little bit wondering how come it happened so quickly to America within 100 years or less. Mm.
Technology.
Yeah, accelerating.
Basically,
right? You know, technology might definitely be a serious accelerant. No, you know. But all that, of course, there are choices that can be made. That's always the thing. That just because you have inexorable forces taking place, so maybe we have to, you know, learn from this and realize that, we have to keep our minds open, realize that actually, just like those disclaimers at the bottom of financial commercials, you know, past performance is no indicator of future performance. So they're on, that's exactly saying, no, conservatism with a small c, I'm not talking about American politics, is wrong, like, factually.
Yeah.
It's a dangerous...
Here's something that I've been wanting to ask. I mean, I'm pretty much... have a view of it, but do you feel that technology dictates public policy?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think they're related. No, they have to be. I mean, I think it's hard to tell which one comes first, right? If technology, the direction is this type of technology generate that type of policy.
The chicken or the egg.
Or that policy generates this type of technology.
Oh, here we go. Timing. Corey Carroll in the house.
Hello.
Happy New Year, Corey.
Yeah, we just hit something you'd be totally down your alley.
Yeah, the person who is going to answer this question that's been bothering me for
policy
decades.
Policy and technology, right?
Corey.
Yeah, so you guys don't know each other, and you definitely should. It's so funny. I mean, you have all these all alumni,
right?
I mean,
we're
doing this like very
New Year's party.
School spirit.
so welcome, Corey. But before I forget the question, because I am, you know, ADD or whatever they call it. I even forgot the term for it. No. Anyway, the question that I was asking Dr. Balick is, you know, do you feel that technology dictates public policy?
It definitely dictates public policy. It has an effect on it. I mean, look, public policy has to take into account the economy, right?
Right.
And technology has a huge effect on the economy. In fact, Balick would know this. I forget the guy's name, but or the group of people who did the research that determined that basically in the long run, the only thing that really grows economies is technological progress.
Oh, well, you know, that's all in your department,
right? So
I love them delegating. So, like an editor.
Yeah. But there is a group of researchers, and it's been held to be fairly valid. Right, then in the long run, it's technology that moves the needle.
It kind of maybe depends on how you define technology. I mean,
it's a very definitional
technological
question,
relationship.
Right?
So that would include who owns the technology, how is it manufactured.
Right, but I mean,
this is like a problem.
If we look at the big picture, I mean, when we went from animal power to say coal, right? That's I would consider that technology. That had a huge effect on global economies, right? Massive. And then with the advent of oil, and you know, basically replacing horse-drawn carriages and, you know, coal-powered steamer ships, right? Everything's oil-powered now. We can fly now. That has a huge effect on the economy,
mm-hmm.
right? So, I mean, yeah, I'm talking about it in a very broad sense. So I think, to your question, Jesse, I think, I wouldn't say that technology dictates public policy, but it certainly has an effect on it.
No, here is something I would like to pose, and this is a question I've been having with another coworker, like quite a, like a couple of debates about. Like, could you consider institutions a type of technology, right? Because, like, say, are property rights a type of technology, right? Like, how broad do you define technology to involve all these bigger cultural? Is language a type of technology that humans have? You know what I mean? Or things
definitely.
Like this.
Oh, my God. Don't talk about a critical technology.
Right? Like, what do we understand by technology?
It's certainly
tricky. And then the question that what I'm pointing out is that problem of relating policy with technology, right? Because you could argue if you define it more broadly, they're both one and the same. It's
well,
just how we deal with
it. Well, I would think that it would have a vast, effect on policy, because if you think about it, if Joe Schmo has a tech company and it needs to break ground in a local area and there's farmers there, he's going to have to, you know, lay out a plan, a business plan that's going to convince City Hall to move those people,
right,
to be able to open it up.
But it's embedded. I mean, I would use the word embedded a little bit. So it's not that it's the same thing. We can go philosophically weird on things always, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really, you could use a postmodern critique to basically
anything.
Argue the old age-old psychological,
sure.
psychedelic observation that everything is the same.
Yeah,
fundamentally and completely, sure. Everything is the same. But let's just not go there right now.
At a certain point, you have to be practical,
yeah,
right?
You know,
yeah.
That's the thing. Also, that's a proper understanding of postmodernity. That yeah, everything depends on the context. That you have to indeed establish your context properly before you make an argument for it to be clear. But wait a second. So let's be more pragmatic here. So it's embedded. So a technology is not just a better mousetrap, right?
Right.
As the idiom goes, but where do you lay it? For whom? Right? It's embedded in a whole institutional arrangement. So, like, imagine here's something that I like to mention all the time. Imagine that tech company that Jesse was just mentioning is not working already embedded within a very post-capitalist, I would say almost, you know, environment in which indeed you get your government, you buy your government officials to expropriate,
right,
you know,
right.
or whatever, yeah, or to not regulate you, or whatever the case may be, to reduce costs. But how about it's an worker owned and operated tech company that then doesn't want to kick the farms out because they're going to raise their kids in this community and they think it's actually quite splendid to have farms
right.
where they live. So their whole horizon, right? Their whole perspective is completely different. Their incentives are different and it would lead to a very different community potentially too. So I don't know if we can give an easy answer here or even attempt to, but I think the point was made importantly how the technology and the society are inexorably connected. At the very least, we got to understand both, you know, to get it.
You know, yeah. I mean, let's look at maybe what I'd say is a huge issue that's on the horizon. You look at automated vehicles, right? That's coming.
Mm-hmm.
So how's that going to impact public policy, right? I mean, so taxi cab drivers, as unions, you know, as employees, as a way of making
right.
a wage, it's gone, right?
Uber is gone for that.
You know,
right. Well, you know, that's funny you say that because of the CEO of Uber, the guy's a real...
Right.
I don't know what I can use as a term, so I'm just going to not say anything.
We'll
not going
to
say anything.
We'll leave it to their imagination.
Right. But he infamously tweeted that he can't wait for automated cars, so he doesn't have to pay drivers anymore. I mean,
but you know, then again, you know, going back to the example I gave, which is really on the local level, and then you know, I'm going to try to ask you guys in the macro scale of things. Another example, you know, where you can avoid that, you can see it in Portland. You cannot drive up to a gas station and fill, you know,
right.
your car with gas.
I was out there like 10 years ago. I remember that.
Do they have service?
Yeah, they have service.
The
they will pour it for you.
I went to fill my own car, my rental car out there. Guy came out yelling at me. I'm like,
yeah.
What?
what did I do?
Right. No. And the thing is, and I ask about it. I mean, I was so curious because I remember the days. I mean, I worked in a gas station when I was a kid. And so I remember, you know, checking the oil and all that kind of stuff and washing the windows. And I just happened to be in Portland for a wedding. And, all of a sudden this person comes out. I mean, even before I pull out my card, the person was already out there. So I started inquiring, and they were saying, well, it's an environmental hassle for the, customer or whoever handles the gasoline, for one. And then second, when you go into a self-service type situation, you're eliminating, you know, jobs.
Yeah.
So, you know, the way the law worked out for everybody was that people were able to keep their jobs, but at the same time, they were able to avoid lawsuits, future lawsuits, you know, for contaminants on the skin or anything like that. And at the same time, it kind of offered a great customer service, which mm-hmm. would bring people back. So, I mean, to me, that makes a lot of sense. But, you know, then again, you know, that's only Portland.
Oregon. And what I would say to that is electric vehicles, right?
Right.
So now whereas, you know, you don't have gasoline dripping, right? There's a chance that somebody might not even have to actually come out and physically plug the car in, right? Even for fast chargers, I mean, you know, in 20 years, you could have something where, I mean, there's a company, a lot of people don't know this. Have you seen, like, the wireless chargers for the cell phones?
I've experimented with that technology several times.
So
it works. It's just utterly impractical under any conditions, ever.
For now.
Just one more thing to carry, right?
The company that came up with that and has the intellectual property on that, they're right up in Altamont Vista Springs. And they gave up
there's
on
a couple of standards, aren't they? Like,
there's a couple
all
of standards
equally useless.
They gave up, actually. You'll be happy to know they gave up on the consumer electronics because they'll never be able to get the range to be sufficient. But they see it as a very relevant application for cars.
For cars, right.
Oh, absolutely. When you sit in your garage, you're in the garage.
Exactly.
In
you just, like, drive right over the pad. Yeah.
No, I'm not against the – snide comments are precisely at the consumer level of somebody always likes that – the idea. Happily, it's actually an interesting technological advance idea because I say it's passé. My latest phone doesn't have even the basic technology. I can't enact any of the pads that I experimented. Yeah. I think I own two of them already. So the latest and greatest Nexus platform, literally,
they said
no. Forget about it. There's a much better solution.
You get USB-C, right?
USB-C.
Yes.
You know, so let's just have a nice symmetrical round metal object. Really, like, Iron Age technology solves the problem better. But of course, when it comes to your electric toothbrush, induction is a wonderful thing, right? You just put it back on the thing and it's charging. But sometimes, the solutions could actually be not only just seem like, not sexy, but more effective. And the whole issue of progress, by the way, philosophically speaking, right? The whole notion that there is such a thing as scientific progress or any kind of progress can be problematic philosophically. But again, within a certain period of time, absolutely. But that does not mean that we are not probably facing some challenges that maybe we're not. I mean, we're certainly going to come out of them changed. That's about as optimistic as we can.
So on an international level, definitely major changes on technology, you know, when it comes to, policy and everything else. I mean, I personally feel that's a lot of the reasons behind current wars.
Mm. I mean,
you need oil, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so without oil, that technology goes to waste. The manufacturer can't produce it. You're losing jobs.
I mean, it'll be really interesting to see how the military-industrial complex responds to the decline of oil. Just as and this isn't even like a tinfoil hat conspiracy theory thing. You can look it up on Wikipedia. You know what the CIA was started out of? It's a really interesting fact. The CIA was originally a private organization. It was the Standard Oil Intelligence Company. Before Standard Oil was broken up into what's now called the Five Sisters, which is like Chevron, Exxon, BP, Shell. I forget the last one. But
sounds like a good horror movie.
Yeah, but no, it was Standard Oil was this like global, just it was an enormous company. It was owned by the Rockefellers and the Flaglers. And they had their own intelligence company internally. So, I mean, with the decline of oil, why? Maybe we're moving to a point where we fight wars just to fight the wars.
Yeah, that's
good point.
I mean, that's why I like to shift the terminology a little bit. I think it's better that we call it's not an industrial military complex that much anymore. It's a financial military complex.
Financial military
complex. That's an interesting euphemism side effect of the whole general financialization of part of the that our economy, our capitalism. One of the big things that I like to distinguish capitalism when it's more or less functioning to kind of a post-capitalist decline that we're living, is precisely the issue of how that structure. Talk about like political technology, maybe you could call it too, but that everything is held, the decision making in the broad sense is not done by big captains of industry as it used to be done, but by financial groups that are owners of that industry. And other things, especially a lot of things that are precisely non-tangible, right? So you can make a hell of a lot of money just like through financial manipulations, and then all you need is to set fire to a region.
Sure.
And if you place your bets right, is there a kind of a shorting logic going on? I don't even know if it comes to play, right? But like in finance, where if you decide that if you want to place a bet on a company or a commodity,
what are they
crashing?
The puts, right?
Well, the options.
Options, right.
You've got calls, you've got puts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but short is specifically when you're betting that it's going to fail, but then the incentives come to kick in that making it in your absolute and increasingly painful interest to make sure that it crumbles. So when
the way to do that is through what's called a credit default swap, which is basically a form of insurance on some sort of a something like a bond, right? Shorts are dangerous because they can go the other way.
Well, but then you have the interest make sure that it doesn't.
You have unlimited downside.
Exactly.
You have unlimited downside with the short. So credit default swap, you have a limited downside, which is just the value of the contract.
Except if they start accumulating all that crap for years. And
yeah, well, you also, I mean, the flip side is, though, I mean, the flip side with that sort of manipulation, though, is you always need somebody else to take the other side of the trade.
Yeah. And now they have a government, they have the public treasury.
Well,
it's guaranteed in some sense. And that's well before the famous bailout and all that. That guarantee was actually part of, one of the famous popular person explains that well, but I can't think with who. But the notion already back in the Clinton years, in some sense already, this kind of go for it. It's okay. We got you. Again, a bad incentive, created. That's policy, but that impacts the very way of thinking of the business community, so the culture, even.
I mean, like,
say.
There is, like...
It's all tied in.
I think it really depends on where you're standing from, because, like, say, you have such a thing as financial innovation, right? Where a lot of people have used the metaphor of it being, like, a labyrinth, where only the rats inside the labyrinth know how to work out, right? And government is outside the labyrinth and is never able to kind of figure out. The rats know the labyrinth really well. They know how to move around it, and they can create new passages if they want. When you go in and try to regulate it, new doors will open and the rats will just continually escape, right? And that metaphor, I think, is quite wonderful to understand kind of that process of how do you policy make on an industry that will create whatever type of innovations in the future, to create like virtual assets pretty much, right?
Well, the flip side though is that you the financial industry, they write their own regulations, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I would say in terms of financial in a so-called financial innovation, I put that in quotes, that doesn't exist in the Western world, or it hasn't in quite some time. I mean, there hasn't been any innovation. I would say the only thing, any real financial innovation we've seen globally in the last probably 30 or 40 years is something like the Grameen Bank, where you have micro lending, more like peer-to-peer
lending.
And that
failed so spectacularly, it breaks your heart, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it got off to a very strong start.
Yeah.
And actually, that's a good book, is Banker to the Poor, Muhammad Yunus.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, he invented it, but now he's so vociferously against it. And it's one of those cases where he let the genie out and it was supposed to be good. But then, I mean, again, it's a tool, right? I mean, it was a good idea. So, yeah,
I would say, you know, this came to mind. I would say you have financial innovation on the African continent, right? Because if they completely bypassed the traditional Western banking model where you have like physical bank branches, where you have like physical money. Basically all banking on the African continent is done by mobile phones. And it has been for quite some time. So, I mean, you know, that's innovation in that you bypass physical infrastructure.
Yeah, right. I
probably
mean,
for the better.
Yeah, the only problem I had with that metaphor is that the rats came out too knowing of your metaphor. In a sense, I think there's a lot of blind running around in circles and just finding whatever racket becomes available or pushing a particular loophole, you know, a regulatory loophole that there's a plan of how to exploit it, possibly even in the short run only, with a broad promise that will never let you, you know, fall really. So you're good if you mess up.
Was it Plato who said that, you know, you can never write enough laws to prevent bad people from doing bad things, and you don't need to write laws for good people to do good things. They're going to do it anyways. There's a philosopher that had a statement something along those lines.
Yeah, it sounds familiar, but I can't confirm or deny.
I guess, right. Then why to write laws is the question, I suppose, right?
I mean, it's my own personal view of government in general is that you can never expect perfection. You can never expect a bulletproof system. You just have to be, I think you have to be pragmatic, and to some degree, unfortunately, you kind of have to accept that government's going to be reactive. I mean, you know, it's always, I think, a good thing to try to be proactive, but you just to be kind of realistic that when it comes to people who are going to manipulate the system for their own gain, you're going to have to be reactive in that.
Yeah, the accountability becomes the key issue that we could evaluate.
And you do have to have the incentives in the right place, right, which is what economics is all about, right? And you know, the incentives, I guess, they're not always just financial to a degree. They're cultural, right? I
mean, right. How do you measure them?
We've placed probably in the Western world, we've probably placed far too much value on financial wealth. You know, that's like in the Western world, it's all about money. That's the ultimate sign of respect. So people chase money. Shocker. Right?
It'd be kind of hard to break that habit. I mean,
no, but
think about it. I mean, throughout history. I mean, from the moment one caveman went to the other and went like, hey, can I get some of that fire?
Never didn't exist before like a few centuries. A very different animal. People sought power, influence over their lives, absolutely, but it wasn't so monetary. You know, there was a lot of other things. It was also less flexible. I mean, But it was different, you know. I'm not saying that the people were selfless or anything like that.
But it still was some sort of trade, though. You know, I mean, it was sort of some kind of compromise.
Trade exists since the dawn of time.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
But the entire value that even psychologically, you know, we often as economists, not enough, of course, but in this show we talk about society, right, more broad and institutions, etc. But we should also talk psychology. Or, well, the problem is psychology and I'm sorry all my psychology friends, is that you guys are even younger and less scientific than we are. I love my psychology friends because they are even less scientific than economists.
They make us look good. They make us look good.
That's terrible. I study psychology here. Come on.
you have to be careful. I'm not saying that it's not valuable. I'm just saying that they have even more hubris sometimes, it appears to me, than economists. And that's quite an accomplishment, because talk about people are proud about stuff that they really don't deserve to be. Economists are pretty high up there. But I'm talking about the human condition, all right? So it's different when you're measured, your value is measured by your economic success. That's a really new, relatively, historically speaking, new creature. And maybe it's also, we're feeling now that it's gone to levels that are ridiculous to any, you know, common sense thinking human being. But again, we're so deep in it, it's hard to realize that that's what's killing us. Remember how we started the show even talking about security a little bit, right?
Right, right.
And we actually in many ways have less security. I mean, the more we go to kind of extreme forms of this post-capitalistic system, people have less economic security. So we're losing that security that a significant portion of the population won for itself thanks to development, industrialization, capitalism, that package.
Well, executed programming or social programming, basically. I mean, the more you're being restrained, the more security you have, the more you're prone to obey the norms and rules of society, or at least the ones that, you know, the people up top put down.
Some of this also is just, it's a little bit more basic on a security level because of, I mean, we're making the same mistake to a degree as the Neanderthals, and in that we pursue specialization and then basically concentration to, you know, that's what a city is. A city is specialization and concentration, right? Concentration in terms of a population, specialization in that everybody operates in their own little silo, right, for economic gain. But, you know, Homo sapiens, right? We had safety in the form of, what would it be? Adventure. I mean, Homo sapiens, like Neanderthals had boats, right? But they would like go out, fish, come right back. You know, they would never just go out beyond the horizon. Homo sapiens did. And what happened was
like that conservatism, conservatives yeah. versus innovators.
Well, what happened was eventually Homo sapiens were fairly widespread. Neanderthals are very concentrated. Eventually, the Neanderthals were subject to these disasters that decimated their populations. The Homo sapiens, while like, you know, they might have lost a lot of people going over the ocean, they just never came back, right? Eventually, they were widespread enough that, you know, they were robust to any sort of localized risk. And now, in a modern times, we're kind of taking the opposite approach. You know, you have to think about this kind of metaphorically. Well, one, on a literal level, by living in dense cities, we're taking the same kind of risk, right? You know, if you think about something like terrorism, dense cities. I mean, you don't hear of terrorism in like the middle of Iowa,
right?
It's not practical terrorism. You're gonna blow up like a single combine or something.
Yeah, or the sheep are appearing dead everywhere and nobody knows why.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just, you know.
It's aliens, no?
And then
the chupacabra.
Then at the same time, you have this risk with specialization, where everybody is specialized. Yes, it's great for economic gains, in that, you know, specialization in trade leads to a greater quantity of product produced, right? Theoretically, everybody can live at a higher level in some sense. But then you get these disconnections where people just don't know anything about someone else's trade and, you know, maybe the culture that's involved with it, right?
Right.
We become very disconnected. And in my opinion, that makes it very difficult to have an effective democracy. You know, I think an effective democracy, you have to be kind of cognizant of everyone else in the system with you.
Right.
Even renovation, right. I would say, too. I mean, you would have to, at the very least, allow for, you know, people trying really weird stuff that's almost surely going to fail.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because without that, again, you have it's a little bit like the famous distinction made by the philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn, in early 60s, between revolutionary and normal science. Not that the normal science is not important and is considered secondary. Mm-hmm. It's just a different kind. That's a refinement, you know, application, all of that kind of work within the framework, right?
Are you saying philosophers are no different than psychologists?
Oh, yeah, totally. Well, philosophers...
I just want to throw in another group in there
completely.
To the thought of stirring up.
Philosophy and mathematics are different than anybody else a little bit, right? They're these kind of meta-disciplines. They're not, you know, they are applied elsewhere, and they have very strange, and actually similar, interestingly, in some sense, criteria that don't apply anywhere else, right? Science is fundamentally different from both mathematics and philosophy. Everybody needs their mathematics and philosophy a little bit, right? Yeah. At least form a logic, if you will. Everybody needs that to understand what the hell they're doing, frankly. And that's how you get in economics, famously, and in other disciplines too, people who are clearly leaders and brilliant people in what they do, but then show kind of middle school level understanding of the some major aspects of their field, because simply it's not in their specialization again.
Right.
So the need for generalists, at the very least, maybe you do need, well, there's the question. I mean, to what extent do you need the how many generalists, how many specialists? That may be a question. But, you know, I got something burning on my mind. Remember, back to your idea about, the thing about service gas stations, right? And automatization. And for those who aren't regular listeners, Corey, for literally years, we can say now. But he's right, you know, so it's good, you know, you gotta yell wolf, even if nobody listens, because there's a wolf coming, you know? And we've mentioned how, you know, lawyering is a dying breed, and then people aren't. So I'm just thinking of all these people sitting in law schools right now who are going to be unemployed.
Yep.
Accountants, already probably unemployed, and it goes on and on and on. So I'm going back. I remember also a proposal that was used in France, and in some of European countries, you do indeed have service gas stations, and a lot of them.
In many Latin American ones, you have gas stations with service. You get to choose there.
You want your own, you right. want a self-serve, or right. do you
or
want
pay a
like,
little bit more for the service?
Yeah.
They're different, but at the core of it, this is the idea here, right? If we don't need as many people working, generally the well-being overall in economic history, the biggest number to look at, right? The well-being of the majority of the population is probably the prime coefficient, the prime thing that impacts it is how much are they needed for labor.
Right.
So, of course, then you have like, you know, a quarter of the population of Africa gets kidnapped. They're needed that much for labor. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, nothing's perfect, as you say. But American working class, actually, or the majority, though, how we, today we say the 99% or what have you, lived relatively better off than other parts of the world in the past century and a half due to the need for their labor, primarily. So they don't need our labor anymore? That's really a big deal. Do solutions such as sharing the unemployment. France started it, the 30-hour work week. The idea was, wait, but you have to pay the people the same for less work. Otherwise, of course, it doesn't work.
Right, yeah.
That's the American solution.
Right.
No, let's just take this worker and put them in. Part-time, you know, and we don't even have to count them as unemployed, so it's a double win, you know.
Yeah.
Even better, let's employ them as permanent, unpaid,
interns.
Interns. Yeah.
Interns.
That's
right.
the new
permanent
the new
unpaid interns.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, we have to joke because otherwise we start crying, but, right? I mean, how can we deal with that and who does that, who is going to shoulder that cost? But I think I agree with Gori that we have to deal with it. I mean, what are we going to do? Just, we don't need 99% of the population or 90, however
whatever
you want to count
is,
it. Yeah, but the majority, significant majority of the population. So what do we want to do? I mean, if we don't provide an opportunity to earn a living through labor or through whatever, or allocate, just give money if you don't want them working.
Well, actually.
Otherwise, what do you want? Gas them?
Well,
that's
you'll
some,
excuse
some
my horrible
happened.
Jewish
no,
humor,
you,
but
no,
yeah,
you have a point.
What?
You have a point.
Drive them into poverty? I think both the great parties, by the way, in America are pretty much the two. I can't use any words. I can't think of any word that I can say on the radio to describe either of the two parties. It's okay. They're not talking about exterminating the population, but so what?
No, but that would
what's
be
your
that
promise?
That would be basically. I mean, history again. The Nazis, you know.
Oh yeah, they protect me.
That's a good example. They were mostly all, you know, going through unemployment.
Sure.
You know, they were basically been slapped in the face from World War One.
Yep.
You know, and you know, all of a sudden, when you have fun, nothing to lose. You know, you go with
you know the irony,
prices.
By the way. There's a horrible economic irony in the story. And I got to give credit. I was blown away, actually. I got a lot of points from me interview with former Fed chairman Bernanke on, it's a nice conservative source. I can look it up. It's a podcast, if you like. But it's kind of mainstream out of Chicago. But I like what they do. Nonetheless, and I do want to give credit where credit, Econ Talk, anybody who likes podcasts, check it out. It's a pretty conservative, somewhat a little bit technical. Anyway, he was the one who kind of mumbled out there that, in fact, the only leader, the only government that responded to the Great Global Depression well, yes. effectively, and successfully was the Nazis.
Yeah.
Hitler was the best macroeconomist, and he kind of slipped. You can imagine him like,
yeah,
polite.
Imagine.
We're not polite society. We're in polite society, it's difficult. And he's not. Is he Jewish? I don't know.
He is.
Oh, he is Jewish. Yeah, he's Jewish. Got the card. He got the same card I got, so I can make an inappropriate Nazi comment. It's a good card to have, you know. Sorry for all you crackers that I have.
But it's true. when you look at it compared to now, you know, the same symptoms. Same exact symptoms of back then are happening right now.
And, you know, to that point, I would say probably the French model is probably the best model is to share the unemployment. Because, let's just say hypothetically, the long run, 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now, assuming that we don't blow ourselves up. Right. Let's just,
that's a big assumption.
That's like just a ridiculous long run.
But let's be optimistic. Let's be optimistic because, you know what, If you want to plan for the whole thing to go awry, it's not that hard. There are plenty of websites. You can get some canned food. It's not glamorous planning for the end.
Just don't be emotionally attached to it.
Yeah, I have yet to purchase that private coffin thing.
Assuming things go forward, right? Mm-hmm. In 1,000 years from now, you aren't going to need human labor, right? Mm. It's just not going to be necessary. It's the rise of the machines. It's inevitable. So what does society look like then? Ideally, it's, you know, probably some sort of a evolved socialist, you know, social democracy, form of communism. I don't know. Maybe we've just decided to let the machines have the whole universe and we killed ourselves off. Who knows? But you don't just step into that in 5 years or 10 years. I mean, you know, there are cultural elements. I mean, this narrative of work hard and get ahead, it's not just an American narrative. I mean, you know, that's close to a global narrative, right? There's this notion of work. There's a psychological value of, you know, a hard day's work and seeing the fruits of your labor, right? That's
dignifies, but to some extent, when you look at like how productivity is paid in most of the U.S., there is no link of it actually becoming a real thing.
I mean,
just in the carpentry sector, I think I have a friend from grad
school. Well, I mean,
you used to see the biological level of gratification, though.
That part you used to see a lot more, you know, maybe 20 or 40 years ago, not today.
Or even, frankly, 200 years ago, that was one of the problems of industrialization, right? This notion that you don't build the thing, you know? I am an artisan and I work and I'm proud of my product.
Yeah, you build the parts.
Modern too, of course.
I mean, you can see it on pretty much on the generations. I mean, you know, my parents, they probably have, well, actually they do, the first radio that they bought back in, you know, 1940s or 30s or whatever it was. You know, today, I can't even tell you how many iPhones I've gone through. Right. You know, I mean, so.
But my point is like still like this, you know, the narrative of work is it's part of culture, mm-hmm. right? So you can't just immediately get rid of that. I mean, I wouldn't see society, even if you went with this massive redistribution of wealth, if all of a sudden you just take work out of the world, I don't see that. I don't see people
changing
it.
It's more like, again, unpacking the whole concept of work a little bit, because again, before manufacturing in factories, the artisanal kind of production was different. It wouldn't make sense then to people to think, well, are you working really? Is somebody paying you for just doing a repetitive work and you really have no connection to the art being done? That is valid. That is proper work. But if you're taking care of your children, you know, you're, that's not valid. That's not real work. Would seem ridiculous to people. So that is a new animal, historically speaking.
What if instead of work you gamble?
That could
to make money.
Why not? Right?
And think about how many industries look more and more like gambling nowadays, rather than actual work.
Yeah, if you're not, if you don't get a carte blanche that the government then promises you that they will rob me and for your sake when you lose. Nothing wrong with that, is there?
Hey, it's a one-hour show.
Oh, it is? Okay. Yeah.
One-hour show.
Yeah, there you go. It's always a surprise on Punkonomics.
I guess that means Rollins won again.
Really?
I suppose, no.
I
don't know.
I'm a horrible alumni, okay?
You can tell how little I know about how sports
anyway,
anymore.
I guess we should say goodbye because got somebody looking at me in the background, so
yeah, we'll get. Yeah, I have to switch over. Okay, you know what can we do? I mean, we definitely opened up on an interesting thing, but something to think about. And I really want to maybe we should dedicate an entire thing to kind of open-mindedly try and explore. I mean, how weird things, looking at the history of a little bit of decisions that have been made and now maybe seem kind of natural to us, but after all, could have gone another way. And try and entertain ideas of how do we deal with that. With that issue, I think it'll speak to the problem of once again requiring dramatic, important, I think necessary changes. I don't know what changes, but necessary changes all around. All right, so we'll come back to that issue of how to adapt to the modern world. At least give us a fighting chance
next Saturday from 1 to 3.
Well, you're on a positive note. I can't believe it.
Yeah, I know. Happy New Year, everybody.
Yay.
Happy New Year.